Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowden. With me from Morgan's Corner, Arkansas, 601 pounds, Barry, who was from Morgan's Corner, Arkansas.
Oh, that was Haystacks Calhoun.
And I am not going to call you Haystacks Rose. Maybe you put on a little bit of weight on vacation, but I don't think we've gotten to that point yet. So here on Breaking Kayfabe, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. Barry, we're going to, in fact, break kayfabe on life. That's what I hear. But no, wait a minute, Barry. Barry, I don't think that's quite enough. Because our good friend and friend of the show, Aaron Bushong, said, you know what? I want a little more emotion out of Bowdrin. I want him to let go with a Breaking Kayfabe on life. Aaron, let me tell you something, buddy. I am the Knight Rider. I'm a fuel-injected suicide machine. I'm a rocker. I'm a roller. I'm an out-of-controller. And we are going to break kayfabe on fucking life. How was that, Greg?
Wow. Aaron Bushong, Christmas just came early, my friend. That was good.
I hope he appreciates it. You know, I try to reach out to the people and help him. So on today's show, we are going to take a special look, a deep dive, if you will, into Houston wrestling. Houston wrestling, good Lord, Barry, was around for about 60 years. The name synonymous with Houston wrestling, of course, is Paul Bosch. And Paul Bosch was a promoter there for, good Lord, probably 40 stinking years, it seems like. And you know, Barry, Paul was one of those rare guys in the wrestling business that even wrestlers liked as a promoter. I reached out to your friend Jerry Briscoe on Twitter, and I asked him, because Jerry famously was once quoted as saying, you know, if every promoter was like Paul Bosch, pro wrestling would be a much better business to work in. And so I reached out to Jerry, and I said, hey, Jerry, did I have the quote right? Was I even close? Jerry's response to me was so true. Paul told me 6 months out what I would do and make, and he kept his word, which was very rare back then. So Paul Bosch, we're going to discuss today in a deep dive. We're going to take a look at one of the main attractions that Houston wrestling had in the late 70s, which was the late great Don Jardine, the spoiler. We're going to take a look at a couple of his matches. And besides that, MD Tyler has been patiently waiting. And Barry, also on today's show, we are going to take our look at our top five movie quotes of all time. Not the comedy versions, not the ones that gave you the preferable chuckles. That's proverbial. It's easy for me to say, Barry. The proverbial chuckles. That's next week, MD. Today, it's our top five favorite movie quotes of all times. And your more serious movies, I guess you could say, Barry. Barry, I know you're ready to do a deep dive on all these issues and maybe more.
Absolutely, too. But I think if I'm looking at my watch right now, it's time for America's favorite game show. Jeff,
what?
Yes, it is time. It is time. And it is time for you to play ball. We are doing a special Jeff Bowdrin's favorite movie of all time, F, Marry, or Kill. I'm taking a little bit of a liberty with this because I am not just going with Blade Runner, but I'm going with, was it Blade Runner 2049 was the sequel?
Okay. Yes, it was.
Okay. So I am, you know, and I had mixed feelings on the movie, but in any case, we are doing an F, Marry, Kill. We are going to take two females from the first movie and one female from the second movie, being Daryl Hannah, Sean Young, who's been making a lot of news lately.
And not in a good way.
Not in a good way. And Robin Wright. Used to be Robin Wright Penn. Right now it's back to Robin Wright, though I heard she just got married this week. So F, Marry, Kill, Daryl Hannah, Sean Young, Robin Wright. What you got, Jeff Bowdrin?
Wow, this is a tougher choice than it seems, because you got Sean Young back in the day was quite the attractive woman, not only in Blade Runner, Stripes. She was in that with PJ Souls as one of the military police officers, was a really, really good in Blade Runner. She was absolutely luminous. Daryl Hannah in Splash was beautiful. And she was good looking even in your, your Tarantino Kill Bill films. But yeah. I've seen lately, maybe some bad plastic surgery. And, of course, we've recently seen. So are we going, like, in the prime or right now?
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. So whenever we do these, what are we talking about? Are we talking about when the movie came out? I would say take your best shot at them. So you could take Daryl Hannah in Splash, or you could take her in Blade Runner. You could take Sean Young, Blade Runner. She was great, really, in the 80s. Anything that she was doing, whether it was Stripes, Blade Runner, And Robin Wright, she's older now, but if you look at Robin Wright 25 and 30 years ago, stunning. I mean, she's a 10.
Robin Wright, of course, besides her Netflix, what the heck is the Netflix show that she did with Spacey?
House of Cards.
House of Cards. And she's still a very beautiful older woman, but she is most famous to this day for being?
Mrs. Sean Penn.
No, not that. Princess Buttercup from A Princess Bride, for God's sakes.
So that's right. What year was that movie?
I want to talk about 85, 87, one of those two, okay. I'm thinking. So here's my selection. Can't help but not exclude the crazy factor on Sean Young. Heard some things about Daryl Hannah being slightly crazy too. So I'm gonna marry Robin Wright because I think that's the good solid choice. Seems a little more stable. Also a really really attractive woman. Let's see if I had a choice. I tell you what. I can't forget how good Sean Young looked in Blade Runner. So I'm going to whack Daryl Hannah, and I'm going to F, as you would say, the living hell out of Sean Young. But the in the prime Sean Young, if you will. Excuse me for discriminating there. I don't want to get myself in a, dare I say, a Dave Meltzer situation.
I knew that for some reason. I knew that's exactly where you were going to go with that. You did say one thing, though. You said, I'm going to take Robin Wright to marry because I believe she's a little more stable. This is a woman that was married and had children with Sean Penn. So
a
I'm
valid
not quite
point.
Sure. Yeah.
So let me real quickly address the Melts because Dave got himself in a little hot water apparently on his show for making a, I guess someone said, you know, an inappropriate comment for Dave Meltzer. It's just another episode of this show, Barry. But yep. He made a point of saying that a certain female had put on a little bit of weight. And I guess the WWE Universe got, I'm sorry, the lady's name was Peyton Royce. I got to be honest with you. I don't watch the current product, so I'm not really big on who Peyton Royce is. But, you know, the thing that struck me. And I have to say this. I was looking at Twitter today, and a guy that I haven't talked to in a long time, but I actually used to write for him, Dave Shear. Dave Shear on Twitter made a point of basically calling Meltzer out and saying, you know, I didn't like the apology either, or he made some sort of comment to that effect. And you know, here's what struck me about what Dave Shear said. He didn't like the fact that Meltzer said it. Okay, number one, I think even Meltzer would agree that he was inappropriate. And quickly after having that pointed out to him by the young lady, he apologized, okay? The fact that he apologized apparently bothered Dave Shear. And I'm sitting here thinking, so if he apologized, he's a bad guy. If he doesn't apologize, he's a bad guy. I feel like Dave Meltzer kind of did his mea culpa. He said something that was kind of idiotic for a guy that is a journalist, let's be honest with you, not just a stupid podcaster like you and I. So he was damned if he do and damned if he don't. Barry, am I missing something there?
No, and you were 100% right, too. So the first thing when I read the comment, and I could see where people, especially in this day and age, and what we know about eating disorders, et cetera, where there would be some heat on Meltzer. First off, what you and I do, we are not journalists by any stretch. We're two guys who are wrestling fans that love pop culture, and we like to break cave on a bunch of shit. At the same time, we say things that are highly inappropriate all the time. We say it about men, women. We don't care. There's no discrimination with this.
It's who we are. So, it's what we do.
It absolutely, and again, we're not journalists. Dave Meltzer has made a six-figure income from being a journalist for the last 30 years. So did he flub up by saying it? He did. I mean, look, he did. It to me, it wasn't the end of the world. People jumped on him like he was butchering small like children. No, he made a mistake. He apologized and he wanted to move on. I think I took this. When I, you know, the fact that this continued on today was that this was an opportunity for people to jump on Meltzer. And there's always been resentment towards Meltzer, or for whatever the reason is. Some people truly enjoy it. I was like ambivalent to it. You want to jump on Meltzer, go for it. I just, you know, to me, it's much ado about nothing. That's what I saw from it.
You know,
he did make a stupid comment. I give you that.
No, I think there's nobody, including Dave, that doesn't realize that he 100% made a stupid comment. I tell you, one of the things that I saw, I'm not sure if it was on Twitter or Facebook, that I thought was a very valid point was a lot of the WWE Universe, the guys that work for the promotion, the other ladies that work for the promotion that chose to jump on Dave on this issue were the same people that, yeah, didn't have much to say when they were going over to wrestle in Saudi Arabia and telling the women, yeah, you got to stay home because, yeah, you know, they just don't like the women over there and they don't want to see them.
No offense. But anybody that works for the WWE that's jumping on Dave Meltzer, a company that's had the Kiss My Ass Club, a company that has degraded women far worse than saying she was better in NXT because she was lighter, you got to be giving me a fucking break. I mean, you know, he did the whole Piggy James thing with Mickie James, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, however long it's been, where they were calling her Piggy James because she was overweight. And she wasn't. She's a beautiful woman. So, you know, there's this real high horse that people will get on, you know, and people put their capes on and want to be these warriors to this, you know, but it's ridiculous. You know, what that company has done to, you know, stereotypes, racial stereotypes, gender, you know, it's ridiculous. And you're going to get on Meltzer for this? Give me a break. It's much different if there's a female who's reading that who's not connected to professional wrestling that want to call him out and say, you know what, you made a really dumb comment considering what, you know, all these eating disorders which are in the public eye, all this could do to a young girl. That's a terrible thing to say. But when you work for a company, when you're getting a fucking paycheck on a weekly basis from that a company that's degraded people, you know, horrifically for years, to say something to me, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree. So you got to say something to your employer before you want to go to Meltzer. But of course they don't.
Yeah. And, you know, as you were sitting there giving a nice little rant there, let me just point out to everybody. No, absolutely. I encourage rants here on this show. And so do you, because, you know, I know how much people like when I get pissed off and on the subject. And we'll get to that later, too. But hey, I'm going to just give you one name. If you want to talk about the way that Dave Meltzer was objectifying someone or Dave Meltzer was making a comment about someone's weight, how often did the, excuse me, Barry, the fucking WWE make fun of Vicky Guerrero, the widow of their former world champion? They used her and ridiculed her and did everything but make her crawl through shit and do the whole Game of Thrones shame, 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 because she didn't look the way that Vince McMahon thought that women should look, which I think we've kind of figured out that. So, yeah. So don't hand me this bullshit about how I'm not accepting Dave Meltzer's apology. You know, hey, he fucking, you're not happy that he apologized. You would have been happy if he didn't apologize. It's like, pick one side or the fucking other. Okay, Barry, now I'm done.
But you know what? At the end of the day, honestly, this is so insignificant to me. He made a stupid off-the-hand comment. It should be buried. It's almost like, okay, it's a slow news week maybe for wrestling, you know, whatever. Why don't we just blow this up and just come down on him? And I think there's always going to be this resentment towards Meltzer from certain people on the inside. You know, whether it's male, female, regardless, there's always going to be people that are like, you know what, he's a, you know, there still is this whole resentment towards Marks. And they're viewing Meltzer as an outsider. You know, some people don't, obviously, and probably shouldn't. If you want to get on Meltzer, go back to the way he used to fucking drool over flying Brian Pillman. You know, he had a massive, massive man crush on Pillman. Give him a hard time about that.
Yeah. So let's go and talk about some other stuff, Barry. So, Barry, I had a chance, I don't know if you have, to watch a lot of the G1 tournament that just took place in Japan. I wanted to give a couple thoughts. Have you had a chance to watch any of it yet? I haven't finished. Let me just tell you a couple things. I am to the point where I have like a few more days to go, but I just want to point out the match between Tomohiro Ishii and Kota Ibushi that was, I don't know, like a week or two into the tournament was just friggin' incredible. Just a lights out match. And I'm really hoping, you know, I've heard reports from our Japanese correspondents, if you will, Ashley and Peter Rosario, who were deep diving literally every day following the tournament, that there are some more matches and that the final nights were really off the charts great. But Kota Ibushi, I got to tell you something, Barry, he just has this look. And, you know, every time someone asks, you know, like Meltzer on Twitter, is Kota Ibushi signed to New Japan? No, he's not signed to a contract. He's like this roving free agent that comes in. He's like the Bruiser Brody of New Japan. He just kind of roams in and out of there. He does this spot, Barry, and I don't know if you've seen a clip of it as opposed to the whole match, but I think he might have been wrestling one of the Tongan guys. But he goes out into the crowd, gets up on a on a next level of a grandstands, and he does basically an acai moonsault from this railing back onto the Tongan who's on the floor. And as incredible a spot it was, you're also sitting there thinking, this guy's got to have some kind of death wish. And these guys taking this, you know, this hard style or this King's Road style, whatever you want to call it, you know, Barry, as much as I enjoy the style, I really worry these guys are just shortening their careers so much. And, you know, there's so many people that we could point to as evidence of them doing this. Dynamite Kid, you know, Mitsuharu Misawa, and the way that they're bodies are just like shells of what they used to be. But so I want to encourage you folks to seek out the match between Ishii and Kota Ibushi. It's a marvelous, marvelous match. I really, really enjoyed it. It was lights out good. One thing I did not like the whole Tongan being pushed, the Tamatanga and those guys being pushed and interfering in all the matches. I really thought for as much good as they did in the G1 tournament, and there was a lot that was good, that was a misstep. And I don't know if the guy just isn't ready for that spot or they just kind of misread the way the crowd would interpret it. I really like the way the final came down to Kota Ibushi versus Tanahashi. And I was talking to Eric Chulminski, who, of course, has his own classic Japanese history Facebook page, about the fact that I really like the fact that in that championship match, you had Kota Ibushi, who was Kenny Omega, because, of course, the winner of the match gets a shot at the New Year's show in the Tokyo Dome. So you have, if Kota Ibushi wins, he gets to face Kenny Omega. They're two tag team partners. They're the Golden Lovers, Barry. But if Tanahashi wins, you have Tanahashi as that former champ for them who's kind of holding on, looking for that one last shot, that one last run with the IWGP title. And it made for a fascinating way of booking the match. I thought in that sense, for as much of a misstep as the Tongans were, I thought that match and the way they set that up, the Booker Gato did a great job. So, Barry, now let me ask you, we recently lost Jim Neidhart. And I know that Jim Neidhart had spent some time in Florida. I wanted to very briefly, Barry, have you tell us just some memories of Jim Neidhart and his tag team with Crusher Khrushchev and Dave Sierra as the Saint. In Florida, I believe, I want to say, was it 84, 85-ish?
Yeah, it was 84, and I believe the very, very beginning of 85, and then they broke them up. And Jim Neidhart, too, I mean, you know, a guy that came from Calgary was, I believe, one of the last wrestlers personally trained by Stu Hart, if I read that correctly. And he spent some time in Florida, spent some time in Mid-South, if I'm correct, spent time in Memphis. You know, but his big success obviously came when he went to the WWF, and it really, you know, the Hart Foundation was kind of a revolutionary tag team. They had some great matches up there, and he was kind of the personality. Brett was maybe essentially the workhorse of the two, and Neidhart was the guy who really displayed the personality with that. But his time in Florida was fairly brief. He was billed as Jim Neidhart. No idea why they went with that name. It's kind of goofy. But he was paired with our good buddy, Dave Sierra, Fidel Sierra, the Cuban Assassin, who was underneath an all-white outfit and a white mask as the Saint. And then they were paired with Barry Darso, who was Crusher Khrushchev, who I think had just come from the Mid-South area, if I'm correct. So it was kind of a patchwork teaming. And it worked, though. It was one of these things that really worked. These guys, I don't think they would ever work together anywhere else. They actually, I know Neidhart and Khrushchev wrestled each other, the Demolition and the Hart Foundation, many times. But it really, really worked, and he was a really good fit for the state of Florida in 84. 84 was a kind of a transition year where, we were unfortunately heading into the downfall of CWF, but they were a bright spot. And I think part of it was, and you could tell this, they were actually having fun doing this gimmick. And I got to speak to Darso about a year or so ago. I think it was like last summer. And I said, you know, I really enjoyed your time when you were down in Florida. He goes, I got to be honest with you. He goes, if I look through my career, that was one of the most fun times I ever had with Dave and Jim Neidhart. So he looked back, you know, here's a guy that, he was in WCW and the WWF and WWE for years, had a lot of success, but he really viewed this, you know, 4 or 5 month stint max in Florida as one of the most fun times he ever had. So Neidhart held the Southern title in Florida for 2 weeks and then was part of the tag titles with Khrushchev for a little longer. I think that went for a couple of months. But a really solid guy. I never enjoyed him in the WWE as much. Partly it was more cartoonish, but he was great in Florida, and he really, you know, some guys are a fit for a territory, and I really felt at that stage he was the perfect fit. So I was sorry to hear about his passing. It's a very sad way that he went. You know, if you read the story, he woke up and I guess was walking in the middle of the night and hit his head, and he may have possibly had a seizure, and he passed away. And I believe he had been fighting either dementia or Alzheimer's.
I actually can tell you something there. I reached out to my friend Greg Good. Greg, as some of you who know Greg may know, is a guy that is privy to some dinners that are held here in Fort Lauderdale with the Legends of Wrestling. Now, these are dinners that I may or may not have used to have gone to, Barry. But they had a chance to have dinner with Jim Neidhart last October, and his daughter came down with him. And the interesting thing, you know, when you talk about that he may have had some dementia or some Alzheimer's-related issues, which you have to figure had to be in some way impacted by stuff that happened during his career. But the way that Greg put it that I thought was a kind of an interesting way of putting it was he said his daughter filled in some of the blanks for Jim while Jim was there. And it was funny because, you know, Greg had mentioned that some of the guys at the dinner had kept in contact with Jim's daughter, and that apparently a day after maybe that it happened, or maybe the same day that it happened, they had reached out to her, and she told them that she was on her way back to Calgary to be with her family. And it was just a devastating loss. So just a really completely horrible way to go. The one thing I will say about the team with Khrushchev in Florida that I felt was a misstep by the promotion, and it was repeated when they went up to the Mid-Atlantic area, is, you know, part of the reason why Barry Darso got over as Crusher Khrushchev was that Bill Watts had him turn and join Nikolai Volkoff and be basically an American Crusher Darso who adopted the ways of a Russian. So here, when this guy comes down to Florida, of course it was featured in the magazines, but if you're a CWF fan or a Mid-Atlantic fan that didn't read the wrestling magazines, you're like, why is this Russian guy talking with like an American accent? They never explained that he was an American turncoat, the character. And I really think that in doing so, it prevented the character from getting over as strong as it would have in both areas. You know, I mean, am I completely off base on that, Barry?
No, I mean, you're applying logic to something that you probably shouldn't be applying logic to. you got to remember, there are guys that jump off of, 6 feet in the air on other guys' heads, and those guys get up and walk away. So, as I tell my son sometimes, you know, when the guys bring out sledgehammers and hit another guy with it and that guy gets up, that doesn't happen in real life. So you're applying logic. I see where you're coming from, but God knows we've seen plenty of goofy shit over the years in professional wrestling. There is an interview that's out there, and it was conducted by our mutual best friend David Penzer, and it was for Hannibal, Devin Nicholson, Hannibal, who runs Hannibal TV, which is a YouTube channel, and he interviewed Jim, and I want to say it was at WrestleCon last year, and it's a little painful to watch. As you watch, Jim gets asked several questions, and he doesn't know the answer and can't respond to it. And it was obvious that it was Alzheimer's, but his memory was definitely gone. And yeah, it certainly wrestling would have played a huge part in that. He was also a football player, and he was a star athlete, I believe, in college as well. So, it's sad. It's sad. And, his daughter, who's Natalia, Natty Neidhart, wrote this piece for Slam Wrestling. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see it or if our readers could see it, but it's really, really touching. And it's written with so much emotion that when you read it, you get goosebumps. It's, you know, really, really sad. He was loved. His family loved him. You know, he had gone through some personal struggles and problems, but it appears that his family never stopped loving him or ever gave up on him. And her words are extremely powerful.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I saw on Facebook, someone had posted a picture of the five guys when they did the Canadian heel angle in the WWE in the late 90s. And the only one left is Brett. And it's just, you know, the guys that are gone are in black and white, and Brett is sitting in the middle in color. And it's such a sad photo. You know, it's so many of those guys, you know, and just gone. And they said that Brett was like the second oldest one. All the guys, you know, that died that were younger than him, Davey Boy, Owen, Pillman. And, you know, the only one that was older than him was Neidhart. So now let's move on, Barry. It's time to talk about a little Houston wrestling. Houston wrestling, of course, was originated, I believe it was by Morris Siegel's brother, who had the promotion for a couple years, then sold it to his brother. Morris Siegel ran the promotion for like 30 years, going into the 50s. Paul Bosch takes it over and runs it for close to 40 years as one of the most beloved promoters in all of wrestling. Much the way that St. Louis was, it was kind of a territory all unto itself, and just a territory that had an amazing, amazing array of talent that went in there. Guys that, you know, Gino Hernandez was a huge deal. Jose Lothario, who we've spoken about on this show before, you know, Bull Curry, and one guy that we're going to focus on today that was a really big deal in Houston in the late 70s was Don Jardine. Jardine was the spoiler. You know, one of the things about Don Jardine that I think was hilarious, Barry, is, you know, he was a guy who was in Mid-Atlantic. They made him the Super Destroyer in the mid-70s. He got over huge there. And he, of course, had been in so many different territories as a spoiler. He goes up to New York, and apparently there's some sort of ban on masked wrestlers appearing in Madison Square Garden. So he wrestles with his mask on, but with the face cut out. So he's like a masked wrestler with his face exposed. It was the singular most ridiculous thing I remember seeing in the magazines. But so anyway, Don Jardine was a real big deal in Houston. And so we're going to take a look at a couple of Don Jardine matches. The first one we're going to talk about, and both of us have had a chance to look at this, is the spoiler, John Jardine, July 27th, 1979, former NWA World Champion Jack Briscoe comes in for a visit to Houston and takes on Don Jardine. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell me what you thought.
Yeah, so, you know, here are really two of my favorite wrestlers of all time, and the spoiler had such an amazing run in CWF when he came in 1978, and he held multiple titles. He was a main event guy. You know, he was doing stuff. You know, everybody talks about The Undertaker and walking the ropes, but you can watch the two matches that we're going to discuss today. The use of the ropes that Jardine uses, it was revolutionary. Nobody else was doing it back in those days, and he really somehow was able to do that. Jack Briscoe, I mean, you and I, we've talked about Jack on this podcast numerous times, and the truth is, anytime we get into an in-depth wrestling conversation, the name Jack Briscoe always comes up. So this for me, I've never seen this match, and I got to say, the quality of this, first off, was really exciting. Considering this is 39 years old, this is pristine quality. I believe this came from Bruce Tharp's NWA Classics on Demand channel, which I do not believe is currently out there, as he sold the NWA to Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins. But I got a chance to watch this match, and I did like it. I liked it a lot. I will say, I don't think I liked it as much as the next match we're going to talk about, and I can definitely discuss why. But there was some fun stuff with this match. So there's a spot, and we're talking, you know, right now about the spoiler and his usage of the ropes. But he gets Jack in a headlock, and then he puts his leg on the rope for added leverage, I guess to add some pressure to the headlock, which I don't think I'd ever seen before, which I thought was super cool. Bronco Lubitsch is standing to, I guess it would be the left of Briscoe, a foot away, completely clueless that any of this is taking place. And Bronco, God bless him, whether he was clueless or just played the clueless ref role extremely well, does a great job, because he literally could be staring right at the action and he's not seeing it, which I just think is great. Gary Hart, so, you know, Gary Hart is somebody that you and I have discussed off air more than once, and I before I think we open up this can, I'll move on, and then we can definitely touch on Gary Hart. But this is interesting. This is a wrestling match, and this is not a brawl. And that's one thing, too, is that, you know, Briscoe was a wrestler. Briscoe could punch. He threw one of the best punches. And, you know, as Briscoe is throwing lefts and rights at the spoiler's midsection too, Paul Bosch is he's doing commentary by himself, so it's a single man doing commentary, and it works. You know, I think initially when I first heard it, I was, you know, it took me a couple of minutes to warm up to it. And then once I did, you realize while he may not be the greatest commentator of all time, he knows what the fuck he's talking about. And that's really, really important. So I really enjoyed his commentary. At about the 9.5 minute mark, Bronco Lubitsch, who really is a star in this match as well, gives Briscoe the rare 25 count as he's counted outside the ring. Bronco, you know, it literally seems like it's about a minute. And, you know, you could just see Bronco going 1, 2, and then he's up to like 25. So, you know, God knows. Jack gets the spoiler in the figure four, and spoiler keeps cracking Bronco's leg, and Bronco is literally stomping on Jardine's arm. At one point, Bronco falls over on his ass, which caused me, as I'm watching this, and I was watching this on my smart TV, I jumped out of my chair off the couch because I was laughing so hard. Hart holds Jardine's leg for the leverage on Briscoe, and Lubitsch sees that, and that calls for a DQ for the first fall. I should say this is a 2 out of 3 falls match. Briscoe wins the second fall with his schoolboy, and, you know, after the match is over, Spoiler attacks Bronco, and he's laying it into Bronco. And Bronco, you know, God, he's in his late 60s at this point. At least it looks like it, and Jack makes the save. But, you know, I think the highlight of this match, and the truthfully, I don't know if these two were matched up as well as they should have been. I always felt, you know, we're going to talk about a spoiler Brody match, and I felt that was a much better match. I thought those two guys were much better suited for each other, and, you know, and Jack Briscoe to me is one of the top 5 professional wrestlers of all time, so this is a good match, but I just feel that, you know, there was some sort of, they weren't as cohesive together as they could have been. What I do like about this match is I do like Bosch's commentary. And like I said, it took me a couple of minutes to get into it, but he brings up this really interesting little tidbit that I don't think I'd ever realized, that Jack Briscoe, Harley Race, and Terry Funk were all Southpaws, and all three were NWA World's Heavyweight Champions. And I never realized, but they all three were left-handed wrestlers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought that was kind of cool. So it's a good match. It's not a great match. I think partly I don't think that they meshed as well together as they could have, which is ironic to me in a sense, because a year earlier they had been working in Florida, and Spoiler was the Florida champion, and Briscoe was number one contender for a while, and they must have worked together for a month or two, and their matches were really good. So, yeah, for some reason, I just don't know if this one just didn't capture it for me as much.
So a couple things that I made note of is that, first of all, Tom Pritchard was sitting ringside with Paul Bosch, excuse me. But it was not commenting on the match, but you do see him sitting there. You know, he makes a mention, and this was a guy that I've never heard of, Barry. I was going to ask you if you – he mentions that the ringside photographer is Jim Caldwell. Have you ever heard that name
before? So I had heard that name, and I don't think I've heard that name since probably 79 or 80. He was part of the fanzine world. He was the African-American guy who was shooting photos down there, and he was the guy. Now, Peter Burkholz, so you mentioned it. Morris Siegel was the guy who was promoting Houston for years, and then Bosch took over. But Bosch's right-hand man was this guy named Peter Burkholz, and he published a book that came out, and I forget what it was called, but it was a collection of photographs taken in Houston at the Sam Houston Coliseum, and I believe this guy, Jim Caldwell, was the actual photographer.
Yeah, I think Peter Burkholz might have been Paul Bosch's son-in-law, now that I think about it.
Yeah, so, I think you're right, too. And, but, and since we're touching on that, do we want to touch on Gino Hernandez?
As far as, oh, that rumor? I think we've actually discussed that rumor before.
I think we did. I think we did, too. Gino was such a, you know, and I know we're going to talk about Gino in the future coming up with another match from Houston, which I actually already watched, and that one kind of blew me away. But, you know, Gino was such a mercurial, and I really wanted to make sure that I was pronouncing that right. So if our boy Laszlo decided to get on top of me on that one, I could, you know, I could make sure I'm saying it right. But he was such a bright star, and there were so many layers to Gino Hernandez. you know, and the big rumor for years was that Paul Bosch was the legitimate father of Gino Hernandez. You know, there's a lot of rumors when it comes to Gino. You know, he was killed by the mob. It wasn't a drug overdose, et cetera. But the big one for years, which people on the inside have confirmed, again, that doesn't mean anything, but that he was the illegitimate son of Bosch, which would explain, I guess, where, you know, because he got, Gino really got his first push working for Bosch. You know, Gino had a very interesting career when he started off. He was a young guy. He looked like a young guy, didn't have much of physique, and was an okay wrestler. Certainly a good-looking guy, and for whatever reason, he went to Detroit. He beat the Sheik and won the U.S. title, which, you know, is just bizarre when you stop and think about it. And he worked, I want to say he worked Georgia briefly, and he worked around, but when he came back to Houston and he was teaming with Jose Lothario and then turned on Jose and turned heel, his career really took off. And he had such an amazing career. And he's one of those guys that, you know, especially because you and I have been reading the sheets for, you know, 30 years at this point, you know, it's ever since Gino passed, but, you know, Gino is one of these guys that he's become legendary in death. And, you know, there's all these stories about him, and, you know, people still, you can get on there's a Facebook group for World Class Wrestling, and they are without a doubt the most unabashed, passionate fans you'll ever meet. Just as they were 30 and 35 years ago, if you go into that group and you say one negative word about the Von Erichs, they'll threaten to kick your ass Texas style. So, yeah, which is really, you know, to me, considering that, you know, that's been over with for 30 years, I get a big kick out of that, and I kind of respect that. So with Gino, it's the same thing. Gino is, you know, he's like a god to a lot of these fans, but just a really interesting guy.
Yeah, and, you know, just a couple last-minute points on this Briscoe spoiler match. I love the fact that Gary Hart, who's sitting at ringside, at one point goes over, grabs the house mic, and shouting towards the spoiler goes, "Spoiler! Spoiler! Over the house mic, okay? The claw! The claw!" As if he really wants to make sure that the spoiler heard the fact that he's calling for the claw. You know, one of the things that I noticed about this, and I thought it would make for an interesting discussion, you know, when Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express were the main event heels in Mid-South, and, you know, we're talking, what, 84 into 85-ish, and were really a big deal in Houston, and you know, whether it's against Rock and Roll, against the Guerrero Brothers, I think they worked, you know, maybe, but they were in there as a regular performer. And one of the things that I remember reading somewhere that Jim Cornette had said was how rabid the crowd was, and especially the Hispanic base that went to the matches in Houston. So here we are, we're basically 5 years before that, and if you look at ringside, it is like watching a Pepperidge Farm commercial, because there are no Hispanic-looking people at ringside. It is all older white people, and I'm talking folks that are a good 55, 60 years old sitting, and, you know, of course, we're not looking up into the grandstands and the cheap seats, but right. At ringside, it's nothing but lily white people, Barry. I don't know if you noticed this. And
I did. So to your point, you just answered your own question. They're not showing you who's up in the rafters. And so I can give you I'll use Miami Beach as a reference. If you look at Miami Beach, and certainly there were African Americans, but a lot of the African Americans were up in the stands. And then as things progressed and we saw the Creole with the Haitian influx into Miami Beach, you know, ringside was still, I don't want to say lily white, but it was still predominantly Caucasian. But if you looked up in the stands, up in the rafters, you know, it could have been 75% Creole. So it was a big difference. Now, Texas was unique, just very similar to Los Angeles, because of the Mexican population, that they were getting a lot of guys coming in from Mexico. So, you know, take out your Mil Mascaris, who was always, you know, he would be the special attraction for the cards in Houston or Dallas or Fort Worth, but guys like El Halcón or Coloso Colasetti, so guys that had been big stars in Mexico were actually working this territory as well, and that's based off of the Mexican fan base.
Sure, and, you know, I find it interesting that in 5 years, you know, basically ringside had become for lack of a better word, Latinized, you know, and the older fan base in Houston had completely been taken away from ringside based on the stories that I've heard Jim Cornette said. Okay, now, Barry, we're going to go to the next match. We're talking November 16th, 1979. This is the spoiler, Don Jardine facing off for the American title against Bruiser Brody. Tell me what you thought of this.
Yeah, so I actually like this match a lot more. And I, you know, of all of the three wrestlers we've discussed, I probably like Jack Briscoe the most. But I like the spoiler a lot. I like Brody a lot. But this match, these two were matched up extremely well. So similar heights, similar physiques. Brody's in the best shape I think I've ever seen him during this match. And Jardine, too, because he wore the long tights and then wore a singlet, a lot of his body was covered up. But you could look at the definition in his chest. This guy was spending a lot of time in the gym. He was in really, really great shape. And what I like about the spoiler, too, was he was very methodical. There was this kind of Johnny Valentine, Lars Anderson almost approach to his matches where he never was like a house of fire. You would never say, you know, this was not like a Wildfire Tommy Rich, you know, he's on fire, fire up. No, he was methodical. He was slow paced, but it worked in his favor. So I really enjoyed this match a lot. I'm blessed and I'm extremely blessed because I get to see Bronco again. He's also the ref for this match. This match turns into a slugfest in the first 2 minutes. These guys go for it. They're punching each other. They're kicking. Chairs are involved. But Brody actually wins the first fall pretty quickly. I think it's like the first minute or so with the big knee. Spoiler rallies and wins the second fall with the claw. And what I liked, if you notice this, and I think Bruce Tharp, and Bruce Tharp actually does the commentary on this match because there was no audio. Bosch didn't record any audio for this one. So Bruce does the commentary, but when the spoiler applies the claw hold to Brody and Brody's on the mat, the spoiler puts his knee on Brody's throat as to hold him on the mat. I thought that was great. I was like, that's like one of those little touches that you see with some of these older matches that I think are so cool. This match turns into a brawl. Brody's choking the spoiler with the mic cable, and Brody delivers the big knee for a second time and actually wins the title. This is they call it the American U.S. title, but I always knew it as the American title. Brody wins the title, and then Brody does an interview after the match that may be one of the best interviews he's ever done. He's super animated, but he's less of that lunatic character that he played in the 80s, and he's very coherent here. He's just a guy like that's, to me, he comes across as a Texan who's really amped up. So I thought the interview was really, really good. The two things out of this, and I know we definitely want to talk about Gary Hart, because, you know, and I know that I've touched on this previously. You and I have talked about this, but I watched the spoiler with his claw. So who, in your opinion, had the best claw in wrestling? It's a hold that you really won't see anymore. I'm not sure that there's anybody out there that does the claw. There's probably somebody, but I'm not aware of the claw being a hold. And the claw, at least in our day, Jeff, we sound like a couple of grandparents, or at least I do, but in our day, the claw was a finisher as well. It really wasn't a transition move. It was a rest hold into a finisher, but it was a hold that we were conditioned to fear. You know, when the spoiler was coming to Florida before he ever arrived, there were photos in the program with him making the claw, and it said, "Beware the claw, the spoiler is coming." So, you know, it was more like, you know, the spoiler's coming, but my God, he's bringing the claw with him. So who, in your opinion, had the best claw in wrestling? And then we can say, who had the worst claw in wrestling?
Well, I think the last guy that I remember using a variation of the claw was Mick Foley as Mankind when he used the mandible claw. And that was, they got that over as a finisher. You know, I'm going to say Fritz was the guy that seemed like he had the most well-known claw. I always found it kind of amusing that somehow the Von Erich boys, whether it was because their father taught them the finishing hold or, you know, their heritage, you know, they somehow managed to, you know how to do it just from heredity, you know, heredity or
they were born with that gift.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. You
know, I'm sure I fucked up that word too. But I know we had Baron von Raschke used it. Blackjack Lanza, Blackjack Mulligan. Blackjack Mulligan really only used it in New York, but I remember they tried to put it over so strong in the early 80s that when he would apply it to one of the jobbers at the TV taping, they would put the, remember the big X they'd put over the screen?
Yes.
So that you couldn't see the damage to the prefrontal lobe that Blackjack Mulligan was doing to the poor, helpless jobber. And I always, you know, when I was a young fan, I could never figure out what, that's his dad. Why is Barry Windham never using the claw hold? And then later in his career, I think maybe when he was the Widowmaker or something like that, I think he started using the claw too.
It was hereditary for him as well.
Of course,
so
yes.
Down in the genes, of course.
Of course. I can't believe Kendall didn't use it. But so I'm going to go. I'm going to go.
In real life, he does, though. Yeah, Kendall in real life is out there just clawing everything to pieces. Sure. Right.
That's how he makes a living. So, yeah. So I guess I'll say Fritz.
Yeah. So here's the thing. So I never saw Fritz because by the time you and I were getting into wrestling, Fritz was a little bit on the wind down. So the only Fritz I've ever seen other than the older and dare I say denim Fritz that we saw in the mid to late 80s, you know, is when we saw that match where he wrestled Giant Baba and the claw was put over like it was the second coming of Christ. They were absolutely, the spoiler had an amazing claw. It looks legitimate, especially in that spot where he's got it on Brody and he's got his knee in Brody's throat. But a guy that you didn't mention was Pac Song.
Oh,
Dam.
Yes.
And Pac Song had a great claw. And what I liked about his claw was he could apply it on anywhere on the body. So he would do it on the head. He would do it on the stomach. But he would get it. There's photos out there. When he did it on the stomach, he would actually grab, let's say, the stomach fat of the guy he's working with, generally Dusty Rhodes. So there was a lot to work with there. He had an ample girth. So he would do it, but you could see Pac legitimately squeezing the fat of Dusty Rhodes, and it just looked awesome. Two guys who I thought from a claw perspective, I didn't buy it. One was two guys you mentioned. One was Baron von Raschke. His version of the claw was different than the other guys. A lot of the guys would do it where their thumb and their middle finger were squeezing the temples, and the Baron would just do it where he would just put his hand on somebody's face. So I didn't quite buy that. And then Blackjack Mulligan, God bless him, because apparently one of the true badasses in wrestling, but his claw just looked like he was just putting his hand on somebody's head. Like, you didn't see any pressure. You didn't see anything. And I just didn't get it out of it. Yeah. Didn't quite work for me.
As you were talking, a guy that I thought of that I don't think he used it on the head, but he used definitely the stomach claw back in the day before even you and I were. It was Killer Kowalski, I think, used the stomach claw. And it was like a finishing move. Okay. So let's get to the elephant in the room here, Barry.
Yes.
Let's talk about Gary Hart. And Gary Hart, in the match where the spoiler faced off with Jack Briscoe, and then there's some other matches we'll talk about later from Houston on another episode. There was a match that featured, I believe the spoiler was represented by J.J. Dillon. Maybe it was Ken Patera. But anyway, J.J. Dillon was there. And I called Barry and I said, you know, I can't believe that J.J. Dillon in this match, and this was, again, late 70s, was so much more effective than Gary Hart. And we started discussing this myth that Gary Hart is one of the greatest managers of all time. Barry, take it from there.
Yeah, so I brought this up, whether it was last week or 2 weeks ago, you know, a lot of this, it tends to, you know, all run together for me. But and I'm also nursing a head injury, so I'm going, what's my name? But in any case, we brought this up, and Gary Hart, as a manager, was overrated. And I'm going to quantify that. I'm not just going to make this blanket statement out there because I know that he's loved by many and idolized. But Gary Hart was a class A manager. He was a first-rate manager up until 1975. And let's give Gary Hart, before we go into what we feel the negatives were, let's talk about the positives. Gary Hart was as equally responsible for Dusty Rhodes turning and getting over as a babyface as Roddy Piper was for Hulk Hogan. You know, and everybody will always say, you know, Piper was responsible. Well, Gary Hart was responsible because it was Gary Hart versus Dusty Rhodes for a solid 6 months. Dusty turned. Gary Hart had his army, whether it was Pak Song, the Mongolian Stomper, the Korean Assassin, didn't matter. He was Professor Tanaka, Dick Slater. He was putting all these guys in front of Dusty Rhodes, and Dusty was knocking him down. And Gary Hart was also not only a very good interview, but he understood the psychology of professional wrestling, but he was also a guy that was taking some really good bumps. In 75, the plane accident occurred in Florida where the plane went down in Tampa Bay, and it was Buddy Cole, Gary Hart, Iron Mike McCord, and the late Bobby Shane. And after that, Gary seemingly never took bumps again. And partly what happens when you watch these matches, and we saw this in the Briscoe match, and I know that we've seen this numerous times, is somebody will go after Hart, and Briscoe goes, and I think he's going after Hart or throwing him in the corner, and Gary just falls down. He won't cooperate, and he won't sell, and he won't take a bump. And there were matches, you know, even in WCW in 89 or 90 when Hart was there, where he was, you know, he was getting punched, and he basically no sells. He doesn't take any sort of a bump. He doesn't go into a corner. His facials don't even change. And I almost feel that, you know, Gary's gotten a free pass based off of his work prior to 1975, where again, he was great. He was a very effective mouthpiece in the Dallas territory where he was the booker, but his interviews were very good. You know, he's managing guys like the One Man Gang and, you know, and Gino and Chris. But he wasn't a guy that would ever take a bump in any form. And when you talk about great managers, and let's be honest, great managers are guys like Jim Cornette. They're guys like Bobby Heenan. Taking a bump from the lead babyface was kind of essential. And to watch Gary won't not cooperate in any form, and that's exactly what it is. It's a non-cooperation. To me it's a massive flaw in the managing game.
Yeah, one of the other things we've discussed, and I'll tell the folks before we began taping here, we were talking about it with Brian last, and you know we talked about the famous I Quit match between Flair and Funk, and there's a sequence in the match when Flair goes to strike Gary, and Gary, whether you call it no sells it or just didn't kind of just shrugged it, and Flair becomes noticeably, if you look at the match, he becomes noticeably annoyed. And I think he kind of shoves Gary out of the way because he just realizes that Gary's not going to do anything. And, you know, especially when you're dealing with, a monster like Bruiser Brody, and you get a shot from a monster and you no sell it, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of having the guy be the monster, you know? And I know Gary was well thought of as a booker. I had no problem with him on the microphone, but at ringside, anyone thinks that Gary Hart was a great manager at ringside must be talking about Gary Hart before the plane crash, because I've just seen too much evidence now of Gary Hart being at ringside. And as far as, you know, we talked about the match last week, the Lawler Funk match from Memphis, and how integral to what made that match really good in my eyes was Jimmy Hart's performance. Jimmy Hart running and being chased by Lawler. And at the end of the match, Lawler catches him, boom, he gives him the shot, and Hart goes down. That's what the manager is supposed to do. And if Gary Hart couldn't do that because of, you know, the problems that he had with his back from the plane crash, well, God bless him. I understand that. But he shouldn't be out there. It could have been like, you know, the guys in New York, you know, Ernie Roth as the Grand Wizard, Fred Blassie, Lou Albano, they never stayed at ringside because for whatever reason, the policy was they accompany their guy to the ring. They could talk on the mic. They could get heat. And then they go to the back. And if Gary's just going to sit there and not do anything, or if he's going to sit there and not take a bump, it's kind of defeating the purpose in my eyes, Barry.
Yeah, when you think, again, you know, we talk about guys like Cornette, Bobby Heenan, but, you know, think about the other guys. Think, you mentioned James J. Dillon, J.J. Dillon. Think of those bumps he took for years, and he took some pretty incredible bumps, and that's what it's about. If you're a manager, you're generally managing the top heels in the territory who are then facing the top baby faces. If you're not going to sell for the Superman, the top babyface in the territory, you shouldn't be out of ringside. And again, I feel for him. If this was all related to the issues and the injuries that he sustained in this plane crash, I certainly can respect that. But, you know, Bobby Heenan at some point realized, okay, I can't manage because of my neck any longer. I have to get behind the mic. And Gary Hart was a great interview. I mean, I dug his whole interview style. I thought it was really unique. But just watching this non-cooperation in the ring with these lack of bumps, that they're not bumps, so that's not even the right verbiage. It's painful to watch. Just really, really painful to watch. You know, Jeff, you saw Sir Oliver Humperdinck. Sir Oliver Humperdinck, I'll say maybe the most underappreciated manager of all time, and I think I may have said that also over the last couple of weeks, because from a national level, you know, he was in WWF as Sir Oliver Humperdinck as a babyface manager doing nothing for Bigelow, and then he was Big Daddy Dink in WCW. But what we saw in Florida, this guy was a top heel in the state for a couple of years with his, you know, with his charges, the guys that he was managing, and just a tremendous, tremendous manager, whether it was an interview or whether the bumps he was taking or, you know, or his actions at ringside. I just, when you see this, it you know, and again, if you and I are incorrect, I want somebody to be able to point it out, because maybe we're not seeing the right footage. You know, maybe we're seeing only certain matches where this was happening, but I do feel that we've seen too much of it now for it to be a coincidence.
Okay, so we're going to leave Houston right now. I can tell you that next week we're going to go back for a second look. Maybe we'll even turn it into a third look, because we've got quite a body of stuff to look at. We're going to take a look at what I thought was a really, really good throwdown brawl that somebody on, I believe on, when I looked up the match on Google, who said it was the best match of 1979. So I'm going to throw that out there and leave that for Barry to decide whether or not he thinks, because certainly 1979, there was tons of great stuff going on. So I just want to have Barry look at it with that context. And we're also going to look at a tag team match between one of the real famous tag teams in the history of Texas wrestling. And they're going to be facing a really good babyface team that I believe we may have spoken about once or twice, that a lot of people don't remember because it's before one of the members really became a national star. So I'll leave you that little tease. So Barry, before we continue, we have a couple things we got to mention. I noted today would have been the 72nd birthday of the man they call Captain Redneck, Dick Murdoch. And you had noted that the man they call The Rock, the original Rock, Don Morocco, had made a comment on your CWF page about his memories of Dick Murdoch.
Yeah, you know, so one of the cool things too, you know, when you start a Facebook group, and we started CWF Archives, I think it's about 6 years ago now. So we've been up for 6 years, and you know, I think originally when I started the group, I just wanted to preserve as much of the history of championship wrestling from Florida as possible. But then, you know, the guys that we grew up watching and idolizing start to creep in the group, and guys like Jerry Briscoe are in the group, you know, and Don Morocco over the last couple of weeks has been really spending a lot of time. And today I went in and I think he commented on 5 different threads. And, you know, for me, that's fucking huge. Like, there's Don Morocco commenting, and he commented, you know, he commented on different arenas. Last week he was commenting, about something that was Hawaii related, but it was something to do with the state of Florida. But today he commented on Jacksonville, and he was commenting on Dick Murdoch. And I just thought it was so cool. And you actually posted in our Facebook group what he said, but he's really, really personable. But Dick Murdoch, I mean, to me, Dick Murdoch, I remember when Dick Murdoch died, and it was 1996, and we lost right around the same time 3 of my favorite wrestlers of all time. And I remember this specifically. I was living in Orlando, Florida. We lost Dick Murdoch, we lost Ray Stevens, and we lost the Missouri Mauler. and it's been 22 years. Like I said, it's 22 years since we lost these guys. But, you know, Murdoch was a guy that was essentially still wrestling. He had wrestled for Jim Cornette just a year or two earlier in Smoky Mountain and was still popping up on shows. And, you know, he died, if I'm correct, he was 49 years old, and he died of a heart attack, which if you look at him, he certainly had the body of a guy that would have a heart attack, you know, because he was kind of a thin frame with this huge beer gut, which they say is the worst type of physique to have. It puts the most strain on your heart. But he was one of the most, you know, entertaining wrestlers. And I know we've discussed this numerous times. There were two Dick Murdochs. There was the Dick Murdoch who was good enough, and I mean that, good enough to be an NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. And then there was the Dick Murdoch who liked to fuck around and have a lot of fun. And there's both versions available on YouTube. But, you know, Morocco had a great comment about Murdoch, that he could drink with Andre the Giant. He couldn't beat him in drinking, but he was close. And he could party and he could stay out all night. He never went to a gym, but he was really one of the best wrestlers of all time. And when we were out to dinner with Dory Funk Jr. and his wife, Marty, they were telling great Dick Murdoch stories, if you remember that, which I know you do. And, yeah, Murdoch is one of those guys. So if I was making a list of 10 guys I would like to be at a CWF Legends Fan Fest that, you know, because they're dead, will never be there, Murdoch would make it at the top 10. I think without a doubt. So, yeah.
So, and one of the things that we talked about is when we read Don Morocco's quote that he left in the group, and I made a notation of it, we couldn't help but start reading it in the voice of our friend Howard Baum, who I believe pays tribute to the Morocco. So I'm sitting here looking at the quote, and I'm sitting here finding myself reading it as Howard Baum doing Don Morocco. Magnum cum laude. Oh, well, from West Texas, Funks, the boy could work with an orange. In fact, he did in Japan. Out of shape, never worked, drank beer with Andre, never as much but close, but could lace him up and go an hour. Anytime, way too soon, respect. So that's what Don Morocco, and I started off doing the Howard Baum, but truly that's Howard Baum's gimmick right there. But yeah, obviously
before anybody asks as well, because I know somebody, you know, invariably whenever I bring up the Morocco name, somebody says, why don't you try to get this guy for one of the CWF Legends Fan Fest? And we have. We reached out. Don does not leave Hawaii any longer. His body, because of the various injuries, and, you know, the guy had a career that I'm going to say spanned, you know, close to 30 years. He really can't fly any longer. So, you know, he lives in Hawaii. I don't think he's ever going to be back on the mainland. If for any reason he was on the mainland, I would make every attempt to build a fan fest around him, because if you saw Don Morocco in the WWF towards the end of his career, that was not the Don Morocco that we saw. We saw, in my opinion, one of the great baby faces and great heels of all time in the state of Florida.
Yeah.
Morocco was that good.
Yeah. And if you ever get a chance to see the Don Morocco that was in Georgia with Roddy Piper, that was great stuff too. How he began chastising Gordon Soley. You never give me credit being the first man to reverse the figure four. You never give me credit for that, Gordon. That was a tremendous angle.
It absolutely was, too. And before I forget, too, so I want to get a couple of things. The next is CWF Legends Fan Fest 4 is coming up November the 3rd. We are in Lutz, Florida. We are headlined by Jerry Briscoe and Pat Patterson, making a very rare Fan Fest appearance. It is the first fan appearance they've ever made together. Two guys that wrestled each other and had a feud in the state of Florida in 1977. And then, of course, on a national level, they were known as McMahon Stooges in the 1990s. So, you know, we're real excited. They'll be joined by Ron and Robert Fuller, the Fuller brothers, making a very rare Florida Fan Fest appearance. I know they do it, I believe, in Alabama and possibly Tennessee, but they don't really do much in the state of Florida. So we're really excited about that. And coming up, we're going to announce the next guest, probably either not next week, but it'll be the week after. But we've got some more guests that we're going to announce. We're real excited. Tickets have been selling. I don't know if you saw it, Jeff, but we have a gentleman coming from the Netherlands to the next CWF Legends Fan Fest. He posted last night in the CWF Legends Facebook group and said, I'm coming all the way from the Netherlands, and I go into the ticket purchases, and lo and behold, this guy is coming from the motherfucking Netherlands to CWF Legends Fan Fest 4. So I'm real excited about that. You can get tickets by going to CWF Legends Facebook group or the Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives Facebook group. There are links to be able to purchase tickets. You can also contact me directly. You can contact Jeff. Our boy Travis Range, John Doe, will be there. Aaron Grafton will be there. And I know that we're trying to shame some more members into joining us as well. But Jeff, I also want to point out that I believe somebody is going to be making a special appearance in the city of brotherly love, the city where we throw snowballs at Santa, and we also make a mean fucking cheesesteak. But I believe somebody from South Florida is going to be coming up here, and really it's just a few days now. It's like 3 days.
Dave Flaherty. No, it's not Dave Flaherty. I will be coming up for the ROH taping at the former ECW Arena. What's it called now, Barry? What's the new name?
It is called the 2300 Arena.
The 2300 Arena. I will be there. I'm looking forward to seeing Jamie Ward, Eric Chulminski. I'm looking forward to meeting Barry's son, Zach. I've never met Zach. And so I hope all of you will reach out to us. We'd like to have a little get together. Barry's buying lunch. No, I'm just kidding. So,
I got to go to the bathroom. Excuse me for a minute.
Speaking of buying, though, you talked about the guy coming all the way from the Netherlands. And I think just because we know this gentleman and he is so magnanimous, I have been told confidentially that since this guy is coming all the way from the Netherlands, that Dave Penzer has said he is willing the first soda that gentleman has at the Fan Fest is on Dave Penzer. Boom.
Wow, money back. $3 sodas. We got to say,
Penzer. Yeah. Money is no object to Dave Penzer. That is what I have been told. So
you don't know Dave Penzer because money is the only object that he's concerned with. So you have to know him. But I'm actually really excited because you're only in town for maybe a day and a half. And I've got a day and a half to show you as many great food spots as humanly possible. Ron Lemieux is actually coming in from Connecticut, where I believe.
Ooh.
Ron, the father of Mario Lemieux, the great Pittsburgh Penguins player. Ron Lemieux will be coming into town. Chris Spiker that I mentioned last week. Chris manages a really, really great donut shop that I have to get over there because they have new flavors. He was texting me. But Chris is going to try to make it. Chris's fiance gets married later this year. His fiance, who's been out of town for 2 or 3 months, she's fantastic, by the way. She's coming back into town that weekend, but he's still going to try to make the show. And I was in contact with Peter Rosario. Peter Rosario, who posts the G1 updates, and he lives in PA. He was going to try to make it, but I believe he and his bride already have plans. But I know that we're actually expecting a decent turnout for not just the ROH show, but a get-together we're going to do probably sometime on Saturday. And you know it's going to involve food, and we'll definitely be talking about Fuck, Marry, and Kill as well, I'm sure.
I can't imagine we'd be doing something so inappropriate. Yeah, I got to tell you, Barry, I don't see Dave Meltzer doing F, Marry, or Kill at this point on his show. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. Also, I wanted to bring it, so after getting the plugs out of the way with the CWF Legends Fan Fest 4 and then Jeff being in the Northeast, and I really encourage you guys, if you're within driving distance of Philadelphia, if it's an hour, 2 hours, even if you can't come to the ROH show that night, you know, whether it's a financial reason or you have other plans, if you want to come in at any point on Friday, and I think Jeff's flight is sometime later on Sunday afternoon, we would love to meet up with you guys. You know, I know that we've got a bunch of Amal Pitts. Amal, calling you out. Mike Lane, calling you out. These guys are an hour.
Wait a minute. I got a guy. Freaking Joshua Greenbaum, Mr. All Over the Facebook Page, lives in Kingston, PA. Hey.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. So
what?
I think he's.
Well, then he needs to update his Facebook page. I can tell you that.
Yeah, well, yeah, he should definitely do that. But he lives in a little town in small town in Virginia called Hopewell. I've never asked him why he's in Hopewell, but he's in Hopewell. But it does say Kingston. But I think Kingston is a little farther. But we've got 3 or 4 guys that I'm aware of, and there's probably more. And I just called 2 of them out that are an hour to 90 minutes. So even if you guys can't come to the ROH show, come meet us for lunch, whether it's Saturday or Sunday. Let's hang out. We'll definitely try to, you know, strong arm you to buy a Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry t-shirt. But you know, honestly, it was just, to me, that's one of the cool things when you get to meet people that, you know, that listen to your podcast and then ridicule you on Facebook. That's absolutely huge for me.
Of course, nothing like it. Barry, today, the day we are recording this, we sadly were told of the news that the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, has passed away. Barry, I reached out to you earlier and I said, Barry, give me your favorite Aretha Franklin song. She was the Queen of Soul.
Yeah, so, you know, this is it. You just said it, and we know that she's been ill for a year at this point. And when you just said it, I get goosebumps all over again. So we're never going to see another Aretha Franklin. And let me quantify that with, there may be more talented singers that will come along, but you will never get somebody who had so much soul coming from inside her in the way that she sang. And she was, they called her the Queen of Soul. She absolutely, you know, she and James Brown were two icons. And for me, I mean, you know, her iconic moment will always be Think in the Blues Brothers. And, you know, you and I, that's one of our favorite movies for so many different reasons. She's fantastic in that movie. Do you know that was her only movie appearance in her entire career, which I was stunned to read that. But, you know, whether you're going Chain of Fools, A Natural Woman, I Say a Little Prayer, Respect, you know, she performed America the Beautiful at WrestleMania III. And then she had a comeback. She had a comeback in 1986 with, you know, Who's Zoomin' Who and Freeway of Love, and a duet with, also with the late George Michael, I Knew You Were Waiting. And I got to admit, I'm a huge George Michael fan as well. You know, we talk about music that maybe it's a guilty pleasure, or, you know, maybe it's something that you like or don't, whatever it is. I love George Michael, but Aretha Franklin, to me, she was one in a million. You cannot replicate, you know, and if you're not familiar with her work, honestly, get on YouTube, listen to it, because she was a dynamo. She was absolutely incredible. And if you ever want to read an interesting story, start to read about her life and her life story, because that right there is, that's book worthy. She was a really interesting person. Some, you know, some real only in Hollywood type shit went down in her life with her husband and her son. And, you know, you got to read some of this stuff. It's really, really out there. But as a talent, this was it. I mean, you know, they just don't get any better than Aretha Franklin. So I think, you know, I was talking with somebody today, and we were talking about the day that Eddie Graham died. This is completely almost off topic, but I said, when Eddie Graham died, it kind of signaled a little bit of the end of my childhood. I realized at that moment that a chapter in my life was closed. And with Aretha Franklin dying, and so many of the people that were in the Blues Brothers have passed away over the last few years for various reasons. You know, it's just really sad, and it's just a chapter that unfortunately is closed and it's over with. So yeah. Rest in peace, Aretha.
And we not too long ago lost Matt Guitar Murphy, who played her husband in the movie. So the one song you didn't mention that I always felt, you know, I watched the movie. Did you ever see the movie with John Cusack, High Fidelity?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So there's a scene towards the end of the movie where he's talking about the whole movie is him doing top five lists, and he does his top five songs about death, or like songs you could play at a funeral. And the song he mentioned was an Aretha Franklin song called Angel, or Calling for an Angel, or Sending Out an Angel, or something like that. And I mentioned that to some people at work today, and I said, have you guys ever heard this Aretha Franklin song? And they're like, no, you know, we've heard Respect and all the other ones. And I played that, and there was a moment in my office where all of a sudden my office got quiet, and I was playing the song, you know, the YouTube on my phone. And for about a minute, people just stopped what they were doing to listen to how beautiful that song is. It's just absolutely incredible. I mentioned, I'm sitting here making notes. I remember the Steely Dan song, Hey 19, which is about a guy who has a relationship with a much younger woman who's 19 years old. And there's a point in the song, Hey 19, where the guy's talking to his girlfriend and he says, hey, that's Aretha Franklin that's on the radio. And the guy realizes that his girlfriend had no idea who Aretha Franklin was. And he was so completely flabbergasted that this young girl that he's dating didn't know who the Queen of Soul was. So, yeah, so definitely respect goes out to R-E-S-P-E-C-T goes out to the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, on her passing. So now, Barry, it is finally time to take care of M.D. Tyler. Should
that's
we go with Mad Dog Tyler?
That's a great wrestling. Yeah, that's
or
a great
MD
wrestling name right there.
MD 2020 Tyler. I don't know which one. So
MD
he asked,
Tyler. Yeah. He worked in Knoxville, didn't he? Didn't he work
I think
in Knoxville
he did,
in 77?
Yes. Yeah. It's Bobby Jagger's tag team partner, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So he asked for our favorite movie quotes some time back now, before vacation, when we had the questions on the Facebook group. And he said, tell me your favorite movie quotes. And I started thinking about it. I said, that's a really damn good question. And I think it's something we could make into a top five list. Not only did we make it into one top five list, Barry, as a special favor from the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, MD, you're not getting just one. You're getting, boom, two top five list. You're going to have to wait till next week for the other one, because tonight we're going to do our top five movie quotes. Next week, we're going to do our top five funniest movie quotes. So expect quite a bit of Big Lebowski next week, if not this week also. So Barry.
Yeah, just warning you right now. Yes,
and I'm going to guess that there's something from friggin' Repo Man.
Well, yeah, I'm nothing if not predictable. So of course there is. There's Repo Man and Big Lebowski. Of course there is.
So before we get to our top five list, I want to throw a quick shout out to some that weren't on my top five list that I think are great movie quotes. I sat there and just started listening. Of course, you know, we've discussed the movie The Warriors on this show many times. Warriors come out to play, which is a great line in that movie. You know, from Jaws, gonna need a bigger boat. From the James Bond movies, what's your name? Bond, James Bond, which is, of course, a great movie quote. Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver, you talking to me? You talking to me? Let's see. We got a great quote from an older movie, Dr. Strangelove, Barry. The classic quote, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. I don't know if you remember that. You've seen that movie, of course, haven't you, Barry?
Of course. Yep.
Yes. And we got Charlie Don't Surf from Apocalypse Now. We've got one of the great unscripted lines of all time, Barry, and I don't know if you knew that this was unscripted. The famous scene in Midnight Cowboy where John Voight and Dustin Hoffman are walking across the street. The taxi driver bumps into Dustin Hoffman and lays on the horn, and Dustin Hoffman classically says, hey, I'm walking here. I'm walking. Did you know that was unscripted, Barry?
I did not. That's improvised? That's fantastic.
Improvised line, yeah, because the taxi driver apparently didn't give a shit that they were filming a movie and wanted Dustin Hoffman to move his ass out of the way. So also, we got from the movie Almost Famous, we've discussed that movie, the scene where the young guy says that he needs to go home, and Kate Hudson says, you are home. I love that. From Princess Bride, my name is Iñigo Montoya. Prepare to die. Let's see, from the movie Heathers, a classic scene, Barry at the funeral. I love my dead gay son.
Right. Yes. I remember that.
Let's see, from JFK, back and to the left, back and to the left. Again, from Apocalypse Now, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Robert Duvall.
All right, Jeff, this is what we're going to do right now. We're going to go in a slightly different direction.
What a turn.
Yeah, I think you're going to like this. I'm going to throw some quotes at you, and I want to see if you can tell me where they're coming from. Now, these quotes are not going to be like my obscure Repo Man. You know, this is shit you're going to be able to get, and I think you're going to have some fun with it. I'll even start off super easy. And I'll even give you the year, if that even helps. Wax on, wax off.
Karate Kid, 1984.
There you go. Excellent. life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you can miss it.
I believe we discussed last week how great Ferris Bueller, kind of it was good, but not great. Ferris Bueller.
There you go. So you're two for two right now. I'll be back.
Terminator, Schwarzenegger, 1984.
Very good. They're here.
Poltergeist, 1982.
Oh, you're on a roll, my friend. Oh, God, the dog wet on the picnic basket.
Vacation, 1985.
Sometimes you got to say, what the fuck?
Wait a minute. I know the movie.
You do know. We just talked about it, too.
God, I'm drawing it completely. I know the movie you're talking about. I can see the scene. Help me out.
Yeah. So we talked about it last week with Rebecca De Mornay.
Oh, Risky Business, of course, 1982.
Risky Business. Okay. Here's one I think you'll have no problem with. No More Yankee My Wanky, The Donger Need Food.
Of course. Yes, we're talking 1984's Molly Ringwald. I'm drawing it completely. But Molly Ringwald, 16 Candles. 16 Candles.
Okay. Right. It's our favorite movie. And my last one for you, Jeff, right now. 67 minutes ago, we, your forefathers, were brought forth upon a most excellent adventure conceived by our new friends Bill and Ted. These two great gentlemen are dedicated to a proposition which was true in my time, just as it's true today. Be excellent to each other and party on, dudes.
I think that's Bill and Ted Esquire.
That's correct, sir.
Yes.
Jeff, I don't think you missed one there. Congratulations, sir.
It's a depressing life I truly lead, I have all this obscure information that I can't ever get paid for. Barry, I'll throw it at you that we've discussed in the past. Get busy living or get busy dying?
I see. There you go. So I'm 0-1. I have no
Shawshank.
Idea. Shawshank. Shawshank. Yeah.
So, okay. So now I'm going to throw – we're going to start our top five. Barry, are you ready?
I am ready. Of course, my list, 1, 2, 3, 4, my list has 27 quotes on it that I now have to narrow down to 5. But I can do that.
What do you think I was doing while you were talking earlier?
I know. I saw your list when you were showing it to me. It looked like there was like 125. So, yes. Yes, you were doing that.
So give me your number 5 favorite movie quote of all time.
My number 5 is Jesus Christ, I got to pick this one out. All right. So my number 5 is going to be this. It's going to be Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads, which is Dr. Emmett Brown in 1985's Back to the Future.
Yeah, great movie, no question about that. So my number 5, Barry, what we've got here is failure to communicate.
That's a great one. Cool Hand Luke right there. Strother Martin, the great Strother Martin.
1967, yes. Great quote. Okay, Barry, number 4?
This is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, Larry. I know you know where that one came from.
Of course. You had to throw one Lebowski in there, right?
I had to. Just be prepared to get a lot of Lebowski next week, because the movie's entirely, it's just all fucking quotes.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a funny story. Today, I'm sitting in court, and we're waiting for the judge to take the bench, and I was talking to an attorney friend of mine, Steve Shate, and I said, what's your favorite movie quote of all time? Okay? And he throws a Kingpin quote at me. And it wasn't the one about the bull. You know, and I was like, wow. And I started thinking for next week's show, wow, Kingpin is definitely a go-to source for friggin' hilarious lines. You know, Big Earn McCracken, he definitely had tons of them. So, all right. So my number 4 movie quote, Barry, a movie we have never talked about before. And I'm not sure that you're going to be able to tell me the name of this movie or the movie that this came from, but it's a movie we should have discussed because it's an absolutely fantastic film. Barry, the quote is, what is the most you've ever lost on a coin toss?
I don't know.
Did you ever see No Country?
For
Old Men. And just a fantastic film. And the scene where he is sitting there with the guy in the general store, I'm trying to think of the movie. Was it No Country for Old Men, or am I completely screwing that title up there? Hold on one second.
No Country for Old Men. Yeah.
But just an incredible – yeah, thank you. And the actor
– Javier Bardem, right?
Javier Bardem. I'm trying to think of what his name was. His name was Anton Chigurh. And he is at this general store, and he tells this guy completely just – it's almost like you're waiting for the guy to pee himself, because that's how intimidated this guy is by what the character that Javier Bardem is playing. You know, Javier Bardem was great in that Bond movie, Skyfall, but he was even better in No Country for Old Men. Just an incredible, incredible. He's hooking up with Penelope Cruz, too, is I think his wife. So, yeah, big shout out to Javier there. Javier, that's a great catch. Needless to say. So, okay, number three, Barry.
Number three, coming from 1984's Repo Man. So a character
See,
named
I
Miller.
Told you that was coming.
You knew that. Well, I've got 20 from Repo Man, so I've got to, I narrowed it down at least for this episode down to this one quote. But there's a character named Miller, and Miller is a guy that apparently ate a lot of acid back in the 60s, and he's played by the great character actor Tracy Walter, who if you don't recognize the name, you would recognize the face. But he plays the kind of shop steward for the repo guys. He cleans out the cars, you know, whatever needs to get done, he does it. But they're standing around a bonfire, and he's talking to Otto, the character played by Emilio Estevez, and he says, "A lot of people don't realize what's really going on. They view life as a bunch of unconnected incidents and things. They don't realize that there's this, like, lattice, oh, coincidence that lays on top of everything. Give you an example. Show you what I mean. Suppose you're thinking about a plate of shrimp. Suddenly somebody will say, like, plate or shrimp or plate of shrimp out of the blue for no explanation. No point in looking for one either. It's all part of the cosmic unconsciousness." Have you ever seen Repo Man yet?
I've never. It's funny because I was telling my wife the other night that I need to download a couple of movies for my flight, and maybe Repo Man is one of the movies that I'll download so that I can watch it on my flight up to Philadelphia. So that has my layover in Atlanta. So it's a 5-hour stinking flight. Oy vey.
So you're going to be you'll be at the Atlanta airport, which is that's one of the most inhumane treatments that anybody could ever go through. There is one saving grace because I think Atlanta is like the major hub because every airline seems to have a stopover in Atlanta, but they've got that one, and you spend time there because you have family there, but what's that one? There's one restaurant in the Atlanta airport that's part of a chain that's all throughout Atlanta where they do the hot dogs and they do
Varsity.
Hot Varsity, thank you. Varsity. So at least you get Varsity, right?
Yeah, but Varsity was on our list of places that were complete garbage because the Varsity that's in downtown Atlanta, I went to a few years back, and it gets like you watch the Travel Channel or the Food Network. They always talk about, and it was complete trash. Just horrible, horrible assembly, like worse than McDonald's. You know, I would rather go to, Sonic and get a burger.
Yeah,
that's how bad it was. So now I'm going to go old school. And by the way, Barry instead of just getting one quote, did a whole kind of soliloquy there. And let me just mention, of course, I could have mentioned Robert Shaw's famous dissertation on the sinking of the USS Indianapolis from Jaws. I could have mentioned.
I was going to do that next.
I was going to. I could do Rutger Hauer on the rooftop in Blade Runner discussing what it means to be human. I'm going strictly for the single sentences. However, that being said, when I get to my favorite, I will offer a bit of a more of a dissertation. In the meantime, number three for me, I'm going 1948. Barry, I know they love when we go really old school, and I'm going really old school by saying, "Top of the world, Ma!" Any idea?
Wow. No.
James Cagney, White Heat. He plays a gangster named Cody Jarrett. And it's probably one of the greatest performances of Cagney's legendary Hollywood career, one of the great gangster films of all time. And Cody Jarrett plays a complete psychopath who's basically browbeaten by his mother and has a mother fixation and spends his entire life trying to do something to appease his mother. And he is a complete psychotic, and it's absolutely a mesmerizing performance. It's basically – I can't believe I'm saying this, but without it, it's the way that Pacino say hello to my little friend.
Oh, Scarface.
Scarface, yeah. That's James Cagney in White Heat as Cody Jarrett.
Right, that's right.
Same kind of over-the-top psychotic character. Okay, give me your number two, Barry.
This is going to be long too, Jeff, so strap in and buckle in. I know what you're thinking. Did he fire 6 shots or only 5? Well, to tell you the truth, in all this excitement, I kind of lost track myself. But being that this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
I gots to know.
When you give a quote and they respond with a quote, that's the way it should be done. Exactly.
Yes, of course. Planted. I give you props for only doing one clip. I didn't have a clip. I could have gone, you know, Josie Wales, right. Or Unforgiven. I tried to stay away from the stuff I've talked about for the most part. But yeah, Dirty Harry, what an iconic movie that is.
And what an iconic quote. I mean, my God, that's
almost as iconic as my number two, Barry. It punched the lotion in the basket.
Oh, wonderful. That's Silence of the Lambs. And so we joke about this, but I'm an admin of the Neil Rogers Facebook group. And Neil Rogers was essentially, as a quick comparison, the Howard Stern of South Florida. He was a radio guy for years. And one of the bits they used to play was Buffalo Bill. That character would actually call plastic surgeons looking to get surgery. And when he would be on the line with them, he would inexplicably just start going, "It puts the lotion in the basket." So every time I hear that, I just start to crack up. But yeah, that's iconic.
Absolutely. Okay, Barry, it is time for your number one favorite movie quote of all time.
Yeah, so this is a non-Lebowski, a non-Repo Man, you know. But so this is, it's only five words, Jeff, which considering that, you know, I think I did three that were super long there. So it's only five words, but 1985's Fletch has a quote in it, which I use in real life. And when I go out, I actually say it. My son has been saying it for the last 4 or 5 years.
Let me see if I can guess which one it is.
Sure.
Put that on the Interheroes tab.
There you go, Jeff. Jeff, you today, honestly, when we're done recording, when you leave your palatial studio, the Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry Palatial Studios, you need to go out to your local convenience store. You need to go buy a lottery ticket or five, because you were 100% on every quote that I tossed you, and I don't even give you the quote or a hint, just saying it's coming from Fletch, and you automatically get it. It's put it on the Underhills tab. Every time my son and I go out and somebody says something or whatever it is, we'll look at each other and go, put it on the Underhills tab. And the beauty of it is most people have no idea what the fuck we're talking about, which makes it all the more fun.
Okay, it's time for my number one. It's from a movie we've never talked about on this show. And I started, you know, going back and I was kind of doing a deep dive. And you know what I do is I pull up the top 50 movie quotes, and I'm really just trying to give myself some ideas. I'm jotting down notes. Then I go to my personal DVD collection. What movie here? Let's see. And it's a movie I don't have, but I remember seeing this, and I remembered in the context of the movie how much I enjoyed not only the quote by the main character, but the response by the antagonist. Barry, the main character, his name was Brian Mills, says, "I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. If you're looking for ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. If you let my daughter go now, that'll be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you. But if you don't, I will look for you. I will find you. And I will kill you." And the response is, "Good luck." From the movie Taken, Barry, with Liam Neeson. You've seen that, of course.
I have, yes.
And it's just a fantastic, and the way that Liam Neeson sells the quote, and then the response from the Albanian bad guy is, you know, just good luck. And it ends up where that's how he ends up catching the guy, because of the word. So a fantastic quote. I love that. MD, thanks for the great question that you offered us, which has enabled us to go down this rabbit hole of great movie quotes. A couple other things I want to talk about, Barry, before we start wrapping things up. Had a chance. I mentioned it to you. I know that we talked about last week that Tom Cruise is your very favorite movie actor of all time. I'm just kind of being a little facetious here. Had a chance to see Mission Impossible 6, the new one. Barry, completely fantastic. Some of the stunts this guy does, whether you like him personally or not, and there's a lot of things about Tom Cruise personally that people dislike, and for probably pretty damn good reason. But this guy is next level crazy as an actor, because some of the stunts he does where he's piloting a copter during this crash scene. And I'm like, why is this guy not giving this to a stuntman? He's hanging by a rope from a copter over the Alps, the Swiss Alps. He is just next level insane, and he has been that way in every one of these movies, and it's just friggin' incredible. I can't recommend this movie enough, Barry.
Yeah, so all the reviews for this movie have been through the roof, and from reviewers that I actually trust, that I trust their judgment and generally agree with their judgment, they all say this is one of the greatest action movies of all time. So I will see it. I went to the theater last Wednesday, and I saw Big Lebowski, which was the 20th anniversary of the release of the movie. So I figured after having seen the movie some 200 times that, sure, I should go see it on the big screen again. So I did. I will say the majority of the people at the movie theater, which was a multiplex, it was to see that movie. And it was, if I'm correct, the entire day was sold out. At least the entire evening was sold out. But everything that I've read, people are just through the roof, and I do want to go see it. And I may even this weekend. It's supposed to be a rain out up in the Northeast. So if it's a rain out, I 100% would go and see this movie. But of course, as we're filming this, we have NXT TakeOver occurring on Saturday.
We're filming this, Barry, are we?
Look, I have a head injury, Jeff. Don't be fatuous, Jeffrey. I have a head injury.
Do you want to tell that story to the good folks? You've mentioned the head injury. Please give us the Reader's Digest version of how you got color last night, Barry, and red makes green wrestling business.
Yeah, and I can post the photo, though it's really fucking graphic. So you know, much to the shock of everybody, I wasn't always bald, though, you know, certainly Joshua Greenbaum thinks I was always bald, but I used to have a full head of hair, but I am bald now, and I'm bald partially by choice. What'd you say, Ozzy? Ozzy got all excited for a minute. And so I was in my shower, I was reaching down to get, like the soap or something. And there's a joke there. I was bending over to pick up the soap.
Hello, doctor.
Exactly. And the shower door is a metallic curved door with a pointy end. Well, I come right up on that. That digs into my skull, and I feel it. Yeah, no big deal. You know, I hit my head all the time, so it's not a big deal. Well, I blot my head with my hand, and there's a big pool of blood. So I get underneath the shower, and I come back out, and I do it again, and my hand is covered with blood. So I figure at this time, I should probably notify my wife. So my wife comes in, she takes a look, she takes a photo, and she's like, we got to get you to the emergency room. We got to go right now. I text you the photo. I was working on my list of quotes, and I'm like, Jeff, I can't do the quotes, and I send you the photo, and you and your wife were, you know, debating, is it going to be stitches or staples? So we applied pressure, and 10 minutes later, the bleeding stopped, and I didn't go to the ER. My wife was saying, we got to go. And, you know, it's like fucking 10 o'clock at night. That's the last place I want to go at 10 o'clock at night if I don't have to. So I didn't, but I was covered in blood. It was gruesome. I'm absolutely fine today, though I keep forgetting where I am. But other than that, everything else is great. So, a little head injury. But, you know, it's either that or my age. It's one of the two. I'm not really sure. But, yeah, we're filming this episode. It's been a great episode to film. and we'll continue. But, again, I don't know what the fuck I'm saying. But in any case, NXT TakeOver is this Saturday night. Jeff, will you be watching NXT TakeOver? And can we discuss this on next week's show? And will you be watching SummerSlam as well?
I can tell you I will not be watching SummerSlam, but I will at some point, if not live Saturday night, before next show, I will make all efforts so we can discuss the NXT TakeOver, because those shows are always good.
They're fantastic, fantastic. And I know we're getting to wrap this up now. We're probably, you know, we're at least approaching, if not over, our 90-minute mark. But one last plug, if you are anywhere near or around Philly this Saturday and Sunday coming up, reach out to me, reach out to Jeff, post in the Facebook group, whatever it is. We can meet you up. We've got something going on Saturday. We can easily get something going on Sunday. We'd like to meet as many people as possible. And this is a very, very rare Northeast appearance for Jeff Bowdrin, who really doesn't go beyond the, you know, like Virginia, if I'm correct. You know, this is really, really rare you're making it up this far.
Well, now that I found out that Greenbaum lives in Virginia, or I should say Greenbaum's hiding in Virginia, possibly
hiding
witness,
in Virginia. Yes.
Could be witness relocation for all we know, Barry. I will not be taking that many trips this far north. So, however, I will encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We're being filmed by Brian Last here for the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next time.
Head injury.
Keep on breaking kayfabe. On love!